Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello once again and welcome to the Beautifully Designed Game podcast. My name is Marcus Marrett and on today's episode I'm very happy to be speaking to a man who is unique in scoring the classic goal that he did in front of the Kop while still producing the visual work for the football club he supports in the same way that another man has managed the club and scored goals for the club. This man has scored goals for the club and produces brilliant visual content for the club. It is Scott McCroy.
Hello, mate. I don't want to boast, but I've actually scored three times at Anfield, twice in front of the Kop. I just thought I'd drop that in, but it's a pleasure. I have, yeah, but I didn't want to talk about it. But as soon as you brought it up, I thought I'd just drop it in. But yeah, we don't have to talk about it anymore. We can move on.
Do you want to just let people know about the goal that I am referring to that other people may well know of? Just so people can get a little bit of an idea.
Do you mean the assist, the back heel assist?
Oh, sorry, the assist, yes. Sorry, it is the assist I'm referring to. Yeah. Well, I think of that as your goal because it is the assist that is...
Hey, makes the goal. Yeah, much like people think of when Guti did that back heel to Zidane, it's thought of within the same sort of, area as that, I know. So yeah. I should remember, because I've watched it probably 2,000 times, but yeah, it was just the guy Manny is a YouTuber. I just saw him over my shoulder, so the ball's come through, and just I knew he was on a hat trick as well. So I just thought, I'll just have this, lay it off for him, and he finished it really well. To be fair, and afterwards he was like, "Mate, thank you so much. I've just scored a hat trick." He was really happy. He's a nice lad as well. So those were good times, mate. Good times playing at the Kop. I don't think it will happen again anytime soon, but glad to say I've done it.
Well, can you introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and where people can find you online?
Sure. So my name's Scott McCroy. I'm a graphic designer / illustrator /... loads of other things, really. And you can find me on... My website is www.scottmccroy.com and my Instagram and Twitter is Scott_McCroy.
Okay, sorry to jump in just picking you up on the long list of things that you could describe yourself as. Can you talk us about your time as an art director at ProDirect? Tell us what what an art director does, and any real standout pieces of work from your time there.
So I went into ProDirect as a junior designer in 2010, and then worked my way up through the company. And it was interesting as throughout this time, so from 2010 to 2019 when I left, when I started, there was no Instagram, there was Twitter, I think, Facebook, yes, but no Instagram, no nothing. Everything was still driven by catalogues, we were brochures, traditional print media advertising. So we used to get briefs daily to, show how do we show this football boot in the best light. If it was a speed boot, how do we show it being fast? There was new technologies that were coming in. So every day there was something new that would that you would have to do, and it was really fun, and sort of over time, with the emergence of Instagram, everything became more photo led. It was just, can you just go and take a picture of a boot in a nice place now? So okay. The sort of the art direction as such, almost, I wouldn't say it dwindled, but it changed. It changed from day-to-day work to almost special, special projects. So, and when I was an art director, but by that time I was doing my illustration work. I was living almost two lives, because I was art directing in the day at ProDirect. So I was hiring, responsible for hiring people and commissioning agencies and whoever to do stuff. Then I was going home at night and I was being the hired hand. I was then illustrating for other art directors. So it was for about a year and a half. It was an interesting time because I was sitting on both sides of the fence. But in terms of projects that I enjoyed, I remember we did, so we had a shop in London, a store on Carnaby Street called LDN19, and we had Frank Lampard. It was before he managed Chelsea, so I think he'd just retired and he was obviously looking to fill his days somehow. So we had him for a good chunk of time. Normally you get these players for an hour, like max, but we had Frank for I think we had it pretty much all day.
Okay.
So the guy who's in charge of the store came up with an idea. We can get him. We can. He knew a magician who was called Troy, who's been on TV on E4. So he said, "Oh, we can do this cool thing with Troy, who I know. We can do the do a card trick with Frank Lampard." So then it came about that we would make a Predator deck of cards. So we physically made a 52 card deck with each player. So each number of card would correspond with a famous player. So Gazza's 8 or 10, I can't remember, but Zidane was the king. Or no, Beckham was the king. Fabian Barthez was the Joker. I remember that.
Oh, really?
Because we had to get a Joker in. So we had this whole list of Predator players that we had got our sort of research to find out, and then we were just dropping them into numbers. So Balak was in there. Gerard got. We commissioned Dan Evans. Dan X Draws is his name on Instagram. If you don't know him, so I sort of was responsible for getting in touch with him and commissioning him. His style.
Sorry, Scott, can you just repeat where people can find Dan online, just as the line cut out, just briefly there?
No worries. It's at Dan X Draws, to the letter X. I think I'm 100% sure it's that. So we commissioned him to make these cards, and we were working, so on one hand, I was working with Dan to work up these portraits because he had done a piece on Conor McGregor for UFC fight back in the day. I can't remember how many years ago now. And I was like, that is perfect. Dan, just do that for this, please. And he was like, yeah, no worries. But then I was working with the magician because he needed for his trick. So the idea for the day was this magician was going to do a surprise trick, and the punchline was that Frank Lampard would appear behind people on the street. There's a video on YouTube. I'll sort out the link, or we can work that out later. But anyway, so I was working with the magician on one hand to create the trick cards he would need, and then working with Dan to create the actual cards that he would need. So that was a fun project, and there's been a few more. We commissioned I Love Dust to do a Boot Bible cover in 2000 and 17. We made a newspaper as well, which we commissioned. Oh my God, I can't remember who it is now. I'm sorry. But yeah, we commissioned a series of portraits of all the old players at war, the old World Cups. I know you're a fan of those, the old Kaisers.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, so we did a hell of a lot of varied stuff at ProDirect. I did learn a lot, you know, even down to kitting out, we had to dress the store on like a weekly basis. So you were doing posters and on-screen graphics and off-screen graphics and flooring and walls, and they would wrap the actual store in physical vinyl patterns of boots and that. So we were sorting all that out as well. It was it's crazy for a period. It was a hell of a lot of stuff we did, varied, and it was good fun. It was good fun to do.
And how do you think working on both sides, as you described it earlier, as during the day being the person that illustrators would need to be getting their work in front of, or the person that would be consciously looking for the right talent for the right briefs, to then be filling the other chair in the evening and working as an illustrator? Do you think having that experience has really helped you with a professional approach as a self-employed illustrator now?
Oh, massively, yeah. I mean, it helped even down to things like pricing jobs, you know? Stuff like that. No one tells you how to price a job. But in the day, I was learning that side of it from the guys at work, and I would almost hear from people I was trying to employ what their rates were. And then I could go home and when people were asking me to quote for a job, I can almost use that information that I had to my advantage. It was a weird situation. I'm not sure many people, you know, do sit both sides of the fence, but it was because I don't think, well, being an art director was something I just almost morphed into. I've always had a good eye for things that I think will work, and you always want to try and do it yourself. Oh, I can do that, but sometimes it's better just to hire someone that knows what they're doing, you know. And it was a good experience, but it was long days as well. It was hard because you were having to the day job, so to speak, was hard and fast deadlines, turning stuff around, getting things off to printers, and then coming home, you're like, right, now I've got to sit down at my computer for 4 hours tonight and work. So yeah, as good as it was from a learning curve, it was also hard. It was some hard days, some hard slogs through the time. It was great.
Is part of that hard slog consciously developing your own signature style and your own art direction? You are someone that I can see a piece of work and feel confident that it's a Scott McCroy piece of work, but at the same time there are variants in your art direction as well. Is that a conscious thing, to be trying new things and to be especially in those early days figuring out what style of work you wanted to do, or did that more just come naturally?
No, it didn't. So that the first piece I ever did was the Ronaldo, the airport poster, which I actually don't think it's on my website, which is crazy if it's not. But I had this idea. I've always, everyone loves the Nike ads, right? And if you don't, then you're just weird. But but yeah, everyone loves them. They represent like a point in time, I think. It was just, for me.
Can you just let people know what Nike ads you are referring to, just, sure. just for anyone.
So it was the 1998 airport advert, the 2000, it's called The Mission, which is when they go and retrieve the football from the robots, and then the 2002 The Cage advert with Eric Cantona and the secret tournament on the boat. So I did some posters based around the idea of, you know, if these adverts were a film, what would the poster look like? I've always had a thing for movie posters, and sort of recently there's a massive not market's the wrong word, but a massive love in for these reimagined movie posters, and a lot of them are better than the originals that you see. So yeah, so going back to the adverts, I illustrated the airport one, which was my favorite one, and that was a style sort of based on, again, like old movie posters. It's not, I wouldn't say it's my most amazing piece of work, but I think people resonate with the advert, and it almost, they bridge that gap that way. And that style is very, very different to where I sort of evolved to. It all happened during 2015, Richard Swarbrick, I don't know if you must be aware of him. He does the like the original guy who did rotoscoping, like type videos. His football animations and videos he does are unbelievable. His Twitter is at Ricky Leaks. But yeah, his videos are phenomenal. And he did this. So it was a Women's World Cup in 2015, and he did this project called Swapsies, it was pronounced with like a S-H-W, Swapsies, but he was sort of looking for artists, because the aim of it was to draw, I think it was every player at the Women's World Cup. And I sort of just messaged him and just said, look, I've done this piece of Ronaldo, I'd love to be a part of it. And I was no one at the time, I just literally started, had this Ronaldo picture and not a lot else. And luckily he's like, yeah, like crack on, mate. You know, I need people to fill out the spaces. So yeah, you're in. And there was loads of people, like, again, Stan Chow was in there, and I think Graham Bandera, who's an editorial cartoonist, but there were some big guys. I think
For the Yorkshire Post.
Yorkshire, yeah. There were some big guys who Richard like cobbled together, and I'm just like Mr. Nobody amongst it all. But I started to develop a little style which is a bit more colourful throughout. And then Fran Kirby, the England striker, she was just coming into the team at the time. Her agent messaged me and said, oh, like, we really like what you've done with the previous player. Do you think you can do one of Fran? And I was, you know, I was like, yeah, sure. Like, I was blown away. I was like, yeah, definitely. So I sort of, that was the first time I almost, I guess, thought about evolving and creating a style as such, or trying to define a style. Those were the first roads, I guess, the first runs on a ladder, and then a few that I did one after that of Karen Bardsley, and then there was one I did of a player called Laure Belleau from France, and that's okay. I get asked about that if yeah, I'll sell it as a print, because that was quite a nice one as well. But yeah, that sort of style, and when people like it, you kind of think, oh, I might be onto something here. So you just kind of experiment and add a bit more, take stuff away. And then, yeah, from there, I just started, you know, illustrating players that I liked. And I wasn't doing paid work at the time, so I was just starting out. So I started I think one Arduino piece came next. I did a piece on Yannick Balassi, because we have a mutual friend who said, "Oh, could you do a piece with Yannick and I'll get it to him?" So I did that. And then I've subsequently done a few like match day images for Yannick down the line. But yeah, okay. I did the Ronaldinho, the Gaza, and then you kind of, again, you're onto something and you think, yeah. And then from then it was just trying to progress and trying to, yeah, keep refining and keep moving on, and then hoping that people see it and want to hire you, because you know we're all in it, you know, we're all hoping to, you know, to get paid for what we do, really. that was always the end goal.
Talking through some of your commercial work, how do you tend to find your work is best seen online? What do you find tends to work best for you in terms of getting your work seen by the right people, and any standout commercial briefs from the past year that you'd like to talk us through?
I think when you say online, I mean how it's like where it's positioned, or.
Well, with the social channels that you use to share your work, or maybe it isn't something that not everyone keeps a track enormously of what's working best for them when it comes to getting their work shown online. Is there any particular social channels that you find work best for you? The reactionary Lionel Messi piece of work you produced really got great traction behind it online.
I think Twitter is, so it used to be Instagram, I think.
Okay.
I think it's Twitter now is more, the work can just be retweeted and shared, so Twitter has got a wider reach. So the last two things I've posted on Twitter, the Messi piece went nuts. Like for something that it took me, I think 45 minutes from when I sat down, when I posted it, and stood up and walked out of my office. The amount of people that saw that, it's crazy. It's mad. So Twitter does have that ability to go far and wide, whereas Instagram is a little bit, you're sort of preaching to the converted a little bit, because your followers see it, and if it, you know, you might grow your following here and there. The Messi piece was crazy, and I put it on LinkedIn as well. And I don't really use LinkedIn too much, but I thought, well, why not? You know, it's gone down well on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd put it on LinkedIn, because there's a lot of, you know, industry people on there, which is it's a bit of a shop window, isn't it? That's full of right people, you know, people in brands, people in magazines or wherever. So. Yeah, it went really well on there. So I think it just goes to show as well. You can spend a lot of time on some pieces, but sometimes it's the idea and conveying the idea well. Doesn't have to be amazing. It's just you're just getting your point across in the easiest to follow way, and just hoping that people can connect with it. And I think that's what that Messi piece. The Messi piece did perfectly, and it's spawned off a lot of inquiries and a, you know, a few jobs. So I was very thankful for that.
Can you talk us through that as a piece of work? Setting yourself a brief to create a visual based on a very high profile topical event at the time. Can you talk us through that as a piece of artwork?
Yeah, I mean, there's not. I don't want to over egg it and say that it was, you know, I had this amazing idea. But I was out for a walk with my son in the morning. I take them out at like 8 o'clock just to sort of clear my head for the day and, you know, just a bit of quiet time, really. And I was listening to TalkSport as I was going around, and the whole world was talking about Messi and him, you know, leaving behind his legacies and whatnot. And then it just sort of... And then I remember sort of hearing this, but then I think a week or so before was the game against Bayern when they got battered. And I remember like someone on the radio said, oh, there's just nothing that, like, there's... Messi's he's got nothing to offer, you know, he's saying. So I was like, oh, well, how do we, could I show this with him almost, that the life has just been drained out of him because of, you know, I guess it was off the field turmoil and all sorts of internal wranglings at the club. And the on-pitch performance wasn't good, but I was just trying to show that in... It's almost like a double-sided story where he's leaving everything behind him, but again, he felt drained because he was almost having to carry the club, and he was seen as this you know, he's the best player in the world, and he is the figurehead of Barcelona. But it was almost like everything he had just had enough. You know, he couldn't do much more because the team wasn't that good. So he was just you know, the sort of the life and the
Just, and the colour itself had been drained away from him, drained, and then the idea of what colours could he then be wearing
could
next.
It leaves it open, doesn't it? It's an open topic, and yeah, as we know, the colour's gone back into him now, and he's staying. But it was a good piece. It did well for me, and I enjoyed doing it because it's a again, it's a way of conveying a story in a succinct and understandable way that people can follow. They don't have to join too many dots. It's all really there for them. And a lot of people were replying on Twitter saying, "Oh, this is so sad," and "No, it's so sad." And they were doing the crying face emojis. And it wasn't meant to be sad. It was almost, but I think it hit people in that in an emotive way. And do that, and you're onto a. If you make people respond to what you do, you're onto a winner, you know, straight off the bat. So, yeah, it worked well, that piece, and I was really happy the way it turned out, and again happy the way it was received.
And working in the field of sports illustration, do you feel it's important to show? How you can produce a reactionary piece like that if you are given a brief to produce a piece of work based on a very topical cultural event happening in the sport, this is how you would interpret that. Because reactionary briefs are quite a prevalent part of the briefs that do come from broadcasters and content providers. And so when kind of directing your own portfolio, do you think it's important to be able to show that you can work in that way?
Yeah, most definitely, because I think it shows that you can A, understand the issue or the result or the story you're trying to get across, and B, that you can then put that idea into practice. You know, like, I guess an art director would think of the idea and get someone to do it for them, whereas in this instance I was, I guess, used my knowledge of sitting on both sides of the fence to art direct myself to come up with the idea and then do it. But now the world is definitely going that way. Like, we did, there was a group of us that did some work for COPA for the Women's World Cup 2018. I know we're in 2020, but I get kind of confused with years and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the last Women's World Cup, they wanted to do a reactionary piece for each game. and we had really, you know, tight deadlines. So we had all agreed that it was, you know, it had to be turned around in like 4 hours of the result. So as soon as the final whistle went, it was like, on goes the stopwatch. Like, here we go. Like, it was full on. It was hard. And they would, the guys at COPA would send over the brief, and then we would have to work to that and try and turn it around quickly. And I think throughout that whole process, you kind of learn that the storytelling process is like, how do I get this across in the most succinct way possible that people understand? And the two guys that do it really well is on Twitter. I'm not sure of their handles, so you have to excuse me for this, but I know their names. Emilio Sansolini, I think he does cool stuff. You know, he does stuff with like clubs' badges, so they'll be like, if Man United beat someone, it'll be like the Devil's trident going into the other team's badge. But he does some really clever stuff. And then Ruben Dangor, I hope I pronounced that correctly, if you're listening.
Yes, Ruben Dangor,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, his stuff, he came about in the World Cup, the last World Cup. I think he did a piece with Gareth Southgate, like the older Southgate, the manager of Gareth Southgate, consoling the penalty, the Southgate that missed the penalty for England. And like that piece, you look at it again, you have an emotional connection to it because we're English and we all lived, well, I did, lived through year in 96. So I know like that, I was gutted on the way out because we would have won that tournament, I've no doubt about it. But you have an emotional connection to that piece, and it doesn't have to be, you know, an amazing painting or portrait. You just have to get it, you have to get the point across. And he does it. Yeah. Every piece he does is just superb. Like, it's they're amazing. And that's kind of, again, going back to the Messi piece, I kind of hoped that would sit in that sort of area, that reactive, not necessarily an oil painting, but, you know, something that could just connect to people and that people liked. But the way the world is going, I think there's definitely more scope for that down the line, yeah, for sure.
Can you talk us through your work as a kit designer? So from not only producing work to promote kits themselves at Pro Direct, you've also designed kits themselves. And it'd be great to get an insight to the production process and what kind of guidelines and what constraints that gives you when it comes to creating the kit visual design.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm not going to say I'm a professional kit designer, because there are people out there that are, and if I say stuff that they might disagree with, but I'll just go with how I understand it. So for example, the Torquay United kits that I did, those are on a base template. So the template exists as a teamwear template, and we just embellish on the top. So I'm sure there's been a load of coverage over the past couple of years about, you know, certain brands using templates and backlash from consumers and whatnot, that teams want originality and all that, which is fine, I get it. But sometimes it's just there are constraints with every single team can't have a unique design. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
So templates are obviously used. So the Torquay United kit was based on an original template, and we did that through ProDirect. They're a partner of Torquay. So I designed it, but it takes a massive inspiration. So I don't really like saying I designed the kit, because ProDirect worked with AIK as well, and we sold their one with the date across the front, and it did really, really well. So the brief from the guys at ProDirect were, you know, can we do something with numbers? Because it was Torquay's anniversary, so it was the year they were formed. And it worked quite well, and it went down really well. The kits themselves are obviously just solid colours, so it works just, you know, it works in that retro sort of throwback feel. So that's a design based on a template. Then if you flip it completely, you'd have a fully customizable jersey. So the ones that I did for FIFA, for the Volta launch, the tournament they did in London, those are like open brief. Here's the shape of the shirt. Go mad, do whatever you want with it. So it's two sides of the coin, and sometimes having a really, really open brief is good, and sometimes it's hard. But the Volta kits, I didn't actually, that job kind of come about by accident, really, because I did, like, the way it works with EA is they have territories, so I was doing some kits for the UK team.
Okay.
And as part of their batch of kits, the Volta kit for London was my responsibility, so, and it was based on a pre-existing template that existed from EA HQ, like over in Canada, and it was decided at that. So I did this London jersey, and I didn't break the template of it. I kind of just tweaked it ever so slightly and flipped it a little bit on its head. I sent it off, and then the guys from EA were like, we've sent this up to Volta, the Volta team and the EA team. They want you to do this, but for every country that's going to be in the Volta tournament. So there was, I ended up in 25 kits. It's one for almost every major city in the world. And again, those were, you know, within a certain design template, but we had to do the front, back, arms. You know, there are different sections of each kit you've got to produce a design for. So it's almost, you've got to understand the process. So those ones are sublimated. So the way that works is a big print will be pressed onto the shirt it's done by like an ink, and when the heat hits the ink, it seeps into the shirt like a gas transfer. I don't want to go too scientific, because I may be wrong, but that's how it works. The ink transfers through a high heat through gas onto the jersey, and that's how the sublimated jersey, like the Nigeria shirt, for example, the famous Nigeria one, is sublimated. That's how they get the pattern on it. And the way those are done is the shirt is, the part is deconstructed, so you'll have the front, the back, and the arms, and the patterns will be pressed onto each part and then stitched together. It's done that way around. So that's
okay,
how these Volta shirts are done exactly the same way. They're done, so when we send the artwork off, we send them to a way where the people at the print house know, right, that's that arm, that's that arm. You lay it out flat for them, and then they do their thing, and they turned out pretty well. But you kind of, what's interesting with the FIFA kits is you design them for the game in a certain way, and then it's like, oh, and by the way, they want to make this one in real life, so can you make it so it's going to be made? So there's another issue, well, not an issue, but, you know, another hurdle you just got to overcome. So yeah, I'm not going to say I'm an expert, but I know enough about the process to get by. I understand my way around printing the kit. And at the Anthony Joshua one there was, again, fully sublimated. That was in game, and then it was, oh, can you, you know, they want to make this now because he's going to wear it in a promo video. So then that had to be put into production. But yeah, you just work with some good guys and know what they're doing, they can guide you through, you know?
Yeah. Has there ever been a time when it's been a real wretch to have to amend one of the kits, even what has seemed like a small amount? You know, you've had to change one part of the visual or one part of the colour at some point that just it has that it matters too much inside of your head because just making that one change, I know it's needed, but it has a disproportionate reaction inside your head as no, can't believe I've had to do that.
Oh, hugely, yeah, it does, but I think it helps knowing the limitations at the start because you can be aware of these things. So, like, when you see, there's a lot of concept kit designers out there and the designs they do are, like, really cool and people are like, oh, make me this kit. And I think, the kit's lovely, but that'll be a pain in the ass to make. You know, because it's the way it's put together and stuff, it's not sometimes not conducive to manufacture. But yeah, the EA one that I did for the Italian, this was for the Italian FIFA region. They got in touch and they wanted something to celebrate. I can't remember what the day it was. The day that the Serie A was sort of formed, it was an anniversary of that.
Okay.
And they wanted, obviously, Italy, is famous for its art and various, you know, facets of its art.
Yeah.
So there was three separate strands to go down, and the one we settled on was a futurism style piece, and they wanted it based on a Italian sort of icon, which is called Tarita, which basically translates to a female with a crown made of turrets, castle. It's quite symbolic for in Italy. So I was learning about that at the same time. I was, okay, I don't know what this is, but I'll look into it. So I had to draw this all out, and I had to, the pictures of it only really exist in sort of old, you know, encyclopedias or old sketches. Now it's not something that is readily available, so I had to really work out how am I going to draw this person, because I've only got old images to go off, and then how am I going to put this onto a kit? So it was like a dual thing, and the way it's
like
put
two
together,
layers to the challenge, yeah.
Two layers. It was like, I've got to learn this, and then I've got to apply it to that. And the way the file is put together, the way it doesn't come across on the image very well. But to make a change, I'll almost have to step back 6 or 7 steps to make one alteration, then come all the way forward again.
Okay. Yeah.
Save it and send it. You know. And then it was like, so when you were getting feedback with, oh, could you just amend this colour to this to have this pattern? It was like, yeah, I can be with you in an hour, because you go all the way back and you come all the way forward again. So at times it was trying. That's just the nature of the job. But it was a good job, and it was something you have to think about and learn and, like, say it. Apply it, and yeah, the kit turned out well, and the guys are really happy with it. So, yeah, I'm just glad they were, you know, it met their brief, and that they were delighted at the end of it.
Very good. There's an area of your work that I've always wanted to ask you about, and that is your WWE and wrestling inspired work, even your piece of work, The Streets Will Never Forget, and that kind of LA kind of golden hour noir feel to it, has that has a real mid-90s WWE feel to me. Can you give us a little insight to your connection to wrestling?
Oh, I was a massive wrestling fan. I'm not ashamed to admit it either. Like growing up.
Okay, you go for it. Yeah.
No, no. Like growing up. So I'm just 34. So when I was sort of, I guess 9, 10, it was the Hulk Hogan, like Ultimate Warrior, Macho Man era. And yeah. The colours, again, you think of the colours that those guys used to wear, like Hulk Hogan's bright yellow, Ultimate Warrior was just everything neon. Then the Macho Man had these ridiculous patterns. And if you look at my work, I'm not going to say, you know, there are some instances where there might be a little bit of the Macho Man's outfits in them, maybe. But yeah. So growing up, I was a massive wrestling fan, and moving into sort of the Stone Cold and the Rock era, I think everyone who followed wrestling, like just the Attitude era, like just loved it. So yeah, like I did a Ric Flair piece because Ric Flair is just the guy, isn't he? He's just a legend of wrestling, just a massive personality. So I was in that piece, I was trying to just convey everything about him and his promos. He talks about his, you know, limousine riding, jet flying. Like you just get these emotive things of him, like in a limo. And yeah, it's just, so that was really fun to do. And the Streets Will Never Forget piece, just swinging over to that one. That was, that came about because when lockdown happened, I guess like a lot of us, work kind of dried up because football stopped. So you're looking at your calendar thinking, no football, like, and then you get the emails that come in like, oh, we've had to postpone this, cancel that. So I had a lot of free time on my hands, which is good. I can spend it with my, you know, family and that.
Yeah.
But throughout like Twitter and that, I was noticing this phrase just kept appearing, like the Streets Will Never Forget. And it's, for those that don't know, the phrase is just about players or instances that had a sort of a short-lived but almost legendary status. So like Michu for that season, like he was, when he scored like 30 goals for Swansea, like the Streets Will Never Forget when Michu was amazing, or like Adel Taarabt, like he was just tearing it up for like for one season. So that was again an idea that was, it was almost, there's this phrase and there's so many offshoots of branches to it, and there's so much to sort of explore and go into, and where do I go with it? So I sort of read a few tweets and looked around a few forums and threw some players in of my own that I just liked, and then just tried to create this poster. And obviously with the Streets reference, it's a little bit GTA in that aspect. I think we all remember the GTA posters. Well, people of a certain age will, but when I was growing up,
Grand Theft Auto posters.
Grand Theft Auto posters. Okay, so yeah. When I was in sort of secondary school, just almost getting into thinking, oh, this is something, you know, graphic design and art is something that I want to do. GTA San Andreas, Vice City came out.
Yeah.
With the artwork. And the guy that did it, there's an artist named Stephen Bliss, and he did all the rock star stuff. And I just remember thinking, like, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to do stuff like that because it's so cool. And I remember when I was I finished my GCSEs and went to college. And I remember I was thinking, like, how does he do it? So I went on his website and I just emailed him. It was like contact. So I was like, sod it, I'll just send him an email and ask him how he does it, and just for a bit of advice. And he wrote back to me and said, I use this software. I think it was called Streamline at the time, Adobe Streamline, before Illustrator had sort of tracing capabilities. He gave me a few insights of what he does. Like, he didn't have to do that. He's like the guy, he's at the top of his craft at the moment. Like, he's riding the Grand Theft Auto wave, like, you know, all the way. He wrote back to me, and I was like, wow, like, thanks, mate. Like, really appreciate it. So that has always stuck with me. If anyone ever, you know, writes me a message or how do I do this, I always try and answer them, because I think, you know, what's 2 minutes of your time to help someone, you know, it's nothing in the grand scheme of things. So yeah, there is a bit of, like, going back to the poster, there is a bit of that feel about it, just because of the layers of characters and the you know, the background of it being the streets and it you know, the backdrop and whatnot. So yeah, that was a fun piece to do that, and it kind of got me through a couple weeks of lockdown. But the thing with sort of self-initiated briefs, which is cool, is that you can just do what you want with them. There's no right or wrong. You can just, you know, if you don't like this, just don't do it. If you don't want to put it out, don't put it out. And you can take your time on it. And sometimes they're good as little breaks. You know, if you've got a load of client work on that's maybe a bit tedious or maybe a bit struggling with it, you think, oh, I'll just do 20 minutes on this job that at least I know what I'm doing, because it's my own my own brief as such. I'll just drop back on this and quickly draw JJ Okocha for an hour, and then I'll go back to that. it was a good piece. And I've always been into posters and stuff, like, again, going back to the Ronaldo 1998 thing. I've always just had this, you know, I don't know, I've just been drawn to designing posters. I think because I'm a graphic designer by sort of trade, that's what I've got my degree in. It's the way of, you know, composition of type and illustration and people and how do you lay things out. There's always that part of me that I still like to do, and a, you know, a good poster kind of ticks all those boxes. So
yeah.
So, yeah.
Was there any particular player who came close to making the final cut to be part of the final composition, but had to just sadly be left on the bench? Was there anyone that was a wretch to not include?
Not off the top of my head. No, I think it's hard because it means so much to different people. That phrase, I think if you said to different people, they would give you a different 10 players. Like, there are some that are tried and tested, like Tarap for me, we're getting a lot of people, and Ben Arthur that year he was at Newcastle, and Lee Trundle, because from sort of the Soccer AM days of him doing like neck rolls and all this stuff, like, so I think the phrase would mean a lot to different people. So there was no one that I can really, not off the top of my head, I'm sure someone will come to me maybe down the line, but yeah, looking at it now, well, there's no one that I can.
Who knows, there might even be a volume 2 at some point.
Yeah, if anyone's got any more players for a volume 2, just send them to me and we can see what we can do. Or maybe I can make it taller. I mean, the poster's quite tall as it is, so I can, we can just add to canvas.
And talking of football kits, give us some insight to your own preference when it comes to kit designs and some of your favourite kits from down the years.
See, this is a tricky one. You mailed me the questions last night, so I listened to Phil's, so I knew this question was gonna arise. It's sometimes with me, it's not about the design as such. It's genuinely how it makes me feel. It's like memories attached to certain kits. So the first kit I ever had was a 1995 Liverpool. It's like a gold kit. It was a third jersey back then. It was a gold one.
Oh, right. Yes.
I remember that. Do you know the one? Like,
yes.
We're talking of Jamie Redknapp, McManaman, And the kits of that season, those three kits of the 1995 Liverpool season, and then going into 1996, which was the big chunky collar. That was like the Robbie Fowler like era for me. So when people ask me, "Oh, how, like, who's your favourite Liverpool player?" Like, yes, Fernando Torres, yes, Steven Gerrard, obviously, but Robbie Fowler was the first guy that I was like, every week he seemed to score goals. I was like, he's known as God, and to me, like when I was younger, he was. So those kits around that time, and a little bit before I was a little bit too young for the classic 89-90 with the specs, the candy with the specs, the Liverpool jersey.
The silver shirt.
Well, the silver was the away, but the home was the you know, the red spec one.
Yeah.
So those Liverpool kits like resonated with me, but my favourite kit, I think, and again, there's nothing major to it, is the, this is a common theme with me, it's the Brazil 1998 home shirt.
From
the World Cup, just the yellow with the green down the sides. I remember when I was younger, I had the England France 98 jersey, and my best mate who I used to play with had the Brazil one, and we used to go play football, a group of us, and I was like, because his mum bought him that, I think by mistake, so they didn't have England, so she bought him the Brazil one because it looked nicer, and I was like,
yeah,
damn, like that kit is just
a happy mistake.
I was like, you've done well there. Like, don't get it wrong. I was happy that I had an England shirt, but that Brazil one was just something else. And then when you saw like Ronaldo, Rivaldo and those lot wearing it was all like tucked in with the blue shorts and the white socks. It's just, they just had this, that Brazil of that time just had an aura around them. Like, they walk out to a pitch and it's like you're seeing, just team from another world. Yeah. That's how I remember it anyway.
Think back to the starting 11 and then go through the bench at the same time.
It's crazy.
Roberto
Carlos and Cafu and then obviously Ronaldo and Rivaldo and that squad they had, like Romario up front with Bebeto and Dunga in midfield. And the thing that let them down was the defence, because they didn't really have decent centre-backs, but they just had an all, like, the commentators and the pundits before the match always be bigging up Brazil, like, oh, it's Brazil. It would come through the screen, you're like, oh my God, these guys are just, they're out of this world. And that kit for me, it does strike a chord with me, that one. I always wanted it. I was so jealous of my mate when he had it. And when I was an adult and I got some money, it's the first thing I did was go on eBay and buy one. And I still wear it now. I've still got it. And I still
good man. Yeah.
Yeah. Still wear it. So yeah, that's probably my, again, it's not a design classic by any stretch, but yeah, I did love that kit.
Yeah, sure. No, I get your reason for picking for that way. Absolutely.
To be fair, you know, the Nike jerseys in 1998, again, it's like the Italy shirt. Like, if you think about Del Piero, like a baggy shirt in Zola.
Yeah.
Italy shirts at that time, the Holland ones, and Bergkamp scored that goal against Argentina. Yeah, and then even going to club at PSG jerseys at the time of 1998, do you know, I saw that. I was in a charity shop like in Torquay probably like 10 years ago, and I saw that PSG jersey on a rail.
Really?
And it was £8. At the time, I didn't have but I didn't have the inclination to, like, oh, I really need that jersey. And I look back at that still and regret it to this day. Oh, yeah, because the kit scene's gone nuts, especially for old PSG era, like that 1998, 1996, 1997, 1998. Yeah,
I'll share a picture on Twitter later today I'll share a picture with you of the couple of PSG shirts that I just happened to come across them very fortunately in the same way that I do most of the ones that I get from eBay. And they are two, without realizing it, I did happen to have two of the shirts I would most want to have, because that's my kind of era as well. Yeah. I think
they picked up. Did you get them before the football shirt phenomenon and that the prices went crazy?
Well, all of mine. The oldest one I've got is one that my mum sent me when I was living in Sydney. The shirt that Michael Owen scored a hat trick for United in.
What, against City?
He scored a hat trick in the Champions League for United away to a German club. I forget who. That's the oldest one I've got. Most of my shirts I've gotten in the past 2 years, and I get mine. 90% of mine I get from eBay, and I rarely pay less than £15 for most of mine. So I just go deep into eBay, and they're all relatively from the past 2 years. So not a collection that's taken me a long time to get. Yeah,
and they're not in that, I suppose, sort of recent shirts. They're not in that classic. In that environment. Yeah. Do you know what shirt I had? Right. And my missus denies it to this day that she threw it away or donated it to the charity shop. Still denies it, but I know she did it. Cameroon sleeveless jersey. I don't know what I was thinking.
Oh, really?
It. You know, the sleeveless one. But I saw it on eBay. Absolutely. It's a good price. And I was like, I'm sure I could pull this off. I couldn't. I've not got the body of a Samuel Eto'o. But I bought it, and I was like, well, I'm never going to wear it because it doesn't really suit my my figure. But it's nice to keep because it's a sleeveless jersey that, you know, was never worn. And then we moved house, and I never saw it again.
Oh, no way.
But she denies it. Still denies it to this day. So, yeah, that's one that got away for me. I wouldn't wear it, but it's a nice one to have just to look at, because it was one of those kits that was of a time. But when I was at ProDirect, so we did an article, because I was producing the Soccer Bible magazine issue 4, and we did an interview with Rigobert Song. The guys went to Puma HQ and did the interview with him, and then they were shooting some kits, and then I think there was one that wasn't there. But Puma then sent it over to the office, and it was a Puma kit that was an all-in-one. So it zipped up at the side. Yeah, I don't think they're allowed to wear it, but it was you got into it like you would a cycling suit. You zipped up the side and you put your legs in and zipped up. It was Puma went through a phase of doing some mad things with Cameroon, but unfortunately, I think they fell foul of a few of the laws. But it's a shame. But they definitely push the envelope out of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And making some big moves recently. I've seen with taking over City from Nike and Neymar's move to Puma. Seem to be big moves.
No, yeah, they're going in the right direction. Neymar's just massive, isn't he? Like they've needed that marquee guy. I think they had Lukaku and Suarez, but Suarez is sort of on the decline, and I'm not sure if Lukaku still wears Puma. I heard that he might be going to Adidas, but if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. But they needed that guy. Again, they had Aguero who was up there for a bit, and they tried Balotelli, but they just needed that real signature iconic face they can just hang their hat on and go, right. And yeah, to be fair, they've done a hell of a job with Neymar to get him. So yeah, it should be interesting to see how they go with him.
Do you have a preference for what football boot you like to wear yourself?
Yes, I do. Yeah, my favourite, so leather, I've got quite wide feet. The boots that I like, I have to wear leather boots. I can't wear like speed boots or anything like that. It has to be like something like a Nike Tempo or the comfiest boot. And I get asked this question like a lot because of my background at Pro Direct, but the comfiest boot I've ever worn is a Mizuno Morelia made in Japan. The leather is insane, and they're just so comfy, and I haven't got a pair at the moment because I sort of wore them out a little bit, but they would always be my suggestion to anyone that was wanting a comfy, like, you know, sturdy and good pair of boots. Mizuno Morelia, definitely. But
very good.
Yeah, I have got. They re-released the Adidas Accelerators, and I bought those when I was at Pro Direct, but they come in half a size too small. So a little bit too tight. They're a little bit too tight on me, but you know the sort of inner me really wants to wear them because it's of the nostalgia factor. But they're just not worth the juice ain't worth the squeeze with them at the moment. So I just stick to them. I wear a pair of New Balance, these leather made in England New Balance ones. The ones that wore at Anfield. Yeah, we got them. So when we played at Anfield, you get kitted out with New Balance stuff. And we got given these boots, the leather made in the UK ones. And they are, again, the leather is phenomenal. So I'm wearing those at the moment. And no complaints at all from me on those.
Oh, really? Oh, very good.
Really good. Yeah, really good.
Brilliant. Scott, can you please remind everybody where they can find you online?
Sure. So my website is www.scottmcroy.com. So that's scottmcroy.com. And my Twitter and Instagram is scott_mcroy. I think it's called an underline.
Underscore.
What's it called? Scott_McCroy at Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, there you go.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Scott, cool. It's been super insightful talking to you today.
Cheers, mate. I appreciate you having me on.
Not at all. And I've no doubt everybody will be looking at what you do as we speak. So thank you very much, Scott.
No worries. Cheers, Marcus. Thanks a lot. Mate.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.